The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with SuperValue Travel Insurance. Don't worry about a thing with great value travel insurance online at supervalue.ie.
Ferdia.
Hello.
Are you all right?
I'm good. How are
Happy
you?
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Very good indeed. This is Ferdia McKenna, by the way, the man sitting in front of me. He's a TV and film director, a novelist, a screenwriter, and occasional rock and roller as well. Ostensibly, you're in here because in your Rocky Devil era, guys, you're about to play Dublin's iconic Toner's Pub for the first time in 35 years on Baggin Street there. You're really just in, though, for a chin wag. So we're going to get to your music activities in a minute. But anyway, how are you, by the way? And I say that in such a way that it goes right back, because it was in the public eye, big time. A 1988 Late Show appearance, you talked openly about your testicular cancer. The cancer impacting on your family's life and, you know, at that stage and since, how is it?
Well, I'm grand. Testicular cancer, I'd never heard of it. Suddenly I had a, you know, a lump in my groin, and I was kind of thought it was an injury, and I went to the doc and he said one thing or another. And I had no idea it was cancer, and I eventually ended up in hospital having an operation. Went from stereo to mono, one flick of the surgeon's blade.
That's not the first time you said that, I'd say.
and it was my friend said the unkindest cut of all, but it was life changing thing. I was through chemo for about 4 or 5 months, hard regime, lost my hair, grew back blonde, then fell out again, and now I have invisible hair. But that was 1988, and I wrote a book about it called Bald Head, and that did quite well. And actually a friend of mine is unwell at the moment, so this is a shout out to Martin to get well soon. He's in St. James. But I think it was a life. I was 30 and I didn't think anything would ever. I was immortal. I was Superman. I had long black hair. I felt like I was in charge of everything. Just got married. And one of the things that came out of the cancer thing was there was a suggestion we wouldn't have kids. So that was a big thing in my head. And I have three children now. So Finn is 18, Bess is 20, and Sienna's 23. So I'm delighted. That's the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
Almost as good as rock and roll.
Right, okay. And you had a brain hemorrhage in 85, 86, and then your marriage, and then all this thing happened. So it's pretty eventful stuff, all right. So you are keeping busy now. Just want to get to something that you've done now, because I don't know too much about it. You've just directed your first movie.
Yeah, I directed a movie. I mean, I've been a movie buff all my life, and I never thought it would happen. I was in here in RTE for 13 years as a producer-director, and I loved it. And I left then, and it caused the recession. You know, the minute I quit RTE, the recession happened, and various... You became a freelancer of
Bloody
everything.
Devil era again.
It is, yeah. I blame him. That's why I've revived him. I want to sort the country out again in Toners and Sunday the 30th. But I think I did a film called All About Eva. It was down in Kildare. I was hired to teach screenwriting to a bunch of writers who'd never written film. And suddenly it grew and grew and grew. And we were going to make a web series, and then the web producer pulled out. And eventually we got money from the arts officer in Kildare County Council. And there was money for a waterworks that was never going to happen. So we made a film for Buttons. And we made a little film noir. It's going to be in the Underground Film Festival, actually, in Dunleary in September, the weekend of September the 10th or 11th or 12th. So it's called All About Eva, old school film noir. It's a bit mad.
A revenge thriller.
Whatever
you read this, in the horse racing community of Kildare.
And there's loads of music in it. You might even hear the Rhythm Kings. You might hear, there's a great composer called Thomas Dunn. There's a band called Tri-Fi, and there's a brilliant Kildare artist called Sive. Absolutely brilliant singer-songwriter. So we use our local actors, local writers, local crew, and we made a feature film, and we shouldn't have been able to do it. We did it in 8 days, handheld cameras.
Okay, it is your first movie, but you've done short film dramas and sitcoms and documentaries and soaps, and you've worked on Fair City and Ross na Ruin and all those things.
Well, now that I'm mature enough to handle the adulation of being a film director at the age of 60, which I was the other day.
Moving swiftly on.
I think I'd embark on a career as a film as a film director. Also, I don't have anything else lined up just at the moment, because being a freelancer, you tend to go from one thing to the other.
Give it a bash. By the way, Custer's last stand-up, I wanted to just remind people, back in 2000, 2001, 2002 direction, you won the BAFTA for Best Drama Series, and you were the producer and script editor?
Yeah, I was a producer on that. It was 2 years, and George McMahon was in that film, if you remember him. He's in Fair City these days. But I think Custer's last stand-up was about a young fella whose idol were comedians like Steve Martin or Eddie Murphy. And he wanted to be a stand-up from the age of 14. So he started practicing his stand-up routines using his family as the raw material. And it was a gorgeous series. It did 2 seasons for the BBC. And that was one of my favourite things that I ever did. And it got BAFTA. And after a while, it can't go any further, because he gets to be 16, 17, and they eventually didn't pursue it. But I often thought, what would happen if you revisited Custer now?
Kind of an Adrian Mole thing. So, you're a bit of a whiz on the typewriter as well. Books, screenplays as well. What's the latest in that scene? Well, I mean, like, you did write a bunch of novels. In fact, The High Kings, and that was made into a movie.
Well, that's
did you get loads of money for that?
I got enough money to buy a suit, and I got enough money to buy a decent guitar, and I did both of those things. And for a while, I had the opportunity to go, and I got a chance to go to LA, I got a chance to do all this. I turned it down. I decided I'd stay in Ireland, and I would I would write, I would stay home, I would raise my kids. I would work, I would kind of do the mad things. I had my rock and roll days. I toured Ireland for, you know, 6 years.
Yeah, but hold on a second.
I didn't really want to go to be a screenwriter in LA. I know it sounds a mad thing, but I decided I'd stay and write three more novels than I did, and I wrote a memoir. And then over the last few years, I guess, now that my kids are older, I'm looking back and I think I made the right decision. Because when I was younger, in the punk era, it was possible to do anything. You know, you decided you wanted to do something. You'd remember that era well. People decided they wanted to be in the band. They had no previous experience. They did it. I've always had that mentality. I want to write a book. I would do it. I want to make a film. I'll do it. It's a crazy thing. For some reason, I've made millions for other people, but I haven't made a million for myself. So I figure this year I'll make a million somehow. I don't know how to do it, but I'll apply the punk do-it-yourself rules, and no doubt the universe will take care of me.
Or buy a lotto ticket. Okay, by the way, like, just on that note, like the Hollywood movie I'm talking about, The Last of the High Kings, we're talking Christina Ricci, we're talking Gabriel Byrne, Jared Leto as well. Like, I mean, it must have opened certain doors, or did it just open doors saying, I'm not going to go through those doors, but that makes me feel really
good. Yeah, it did, yeah. And also, Jared Leto became a legend, because he not only did he win the BAFTA for Dallas Buyers Club, but he also was in the band called 30 Seconds from Mars. Happened to be my son Finn's favourite band.
Really?
So suddenly I was huge in the family.
So your son Finn doesn't really have very good taste then, yeah?
He's great taste in fathers.
Right, oh, very good, okay. Okay, by the way, the Rocky Years you've written as well, which is the story of almost a legend, and we're going to get to talk about Rocky, because that's a pretty recent book, well, 10 years ago or 9 years ago, whatever. And then The Last of the High Kings was republished as well in the Modern Irish Classic series, no less.
Yeah,
come on.
Dermot Bulger, the moving beard, who's probably he was the literary equivalent to punk rock. Because he published my book Bald Head, which is about cancer, and he also published me, he gave me a voice as a writer, which would be my fundamental thing. My thing would be I write. That's my interest in life, in terms of artistic pursuits, and that's what everything else I've done, either movies or songwriting or even being on stage, goes back to being a writer. But he gave me a voice, and I've always been grateful for it. And he republished The Last of the High Kings a couple of years ago as an Irish classic. So I feel like I'm kind of a treasured fossil now. One of these guilty pleasures. I'm the equivalent of finding an ELO album at the back of your, you know,
indeed,
collection.
It's not on the leaving cert or anything like that yet, is it?
No, but I think that's a brilliant idea.
Approval. Well, exactly. Yeah. In there with Soundings. Okay, so like you mentioned the stuff about teaching others, and it's all sort of creative writing and screenwriting and TV broadcasting. You were writer in residence in DCU in 2000. You, as you say, mentored several novelists and taught studio and multicam and everything. But I want to leave all that behind to get to the music for a second. Because the far-off, heady days of Ireland in the 1980s. Was it really better musically back then, or are we now just a pair of grumpy old men?
I'd say we're a pair of grumpy old men, and the music is brilliant today as well. But I think it was wilder back then, because the adults didn't know what we were doing. And also because of places like Toners and the Baggot Street Strip, you know, Baggot Inn, the scene was different. We took it for granted. But when you look back at the freedoms that we had and how different everything was, and how Monday night was a rock and roll night, how there were venues in Bray, Port Leash, Sir Henry's in Cork. It was just an amazing amount of gigs. I don't think anyone made that much money out of it. I don't think that was the point. You were doing music because you could and because you loved it. I mean, when I formed music, it was the punk era, as I said, and I was coming out of UCD. I had a kind of honours degree in English. And I thought, well, you know, this is a chance to rock and roll. This is a chance to do something mad. And by accident, we became Rocky De Valera and the Gravediggers, because nobody could play. That was the whole point, except my friend Dave Sweeney could play guitar, and he was brilliant. We recruited people. Nobody was interested in the music I was interested in, which was rock and roll. There's an album called by Robert Gordon and Link Wray, and it's their Robert Gordon's first album, and it came out in the height of the punk era, and it was doing old-fashioned 50s rockabilly rock and roll, but with a punk attitude. And that's the thing that I loved. So when everyone else was writing XTC talking headstyle songs, I was writing baby songs, like something that was really primal, down to earth. If you want the definitive song that I loved would be Brand New Cadillac by Vince Taylor,
right?
And then the Clash went and did
Clash
it,
did
you
it
know, after we did it. So I kind of blame them for ruin. But I've done that. I mean, we'll be doing that in Toners on the Sunday the 30th, because it's the song that defines everything I love about rock and roll. So songs that are primal, down to earth, and rockabilly. It's very hard not to feel great when you put on a rockabilly track.
Well, then let's hear a little bit of music of Rocky De Valera and the Gravediggers.
Here she comes again, looking cool, the ground melts under my feet. All the guys are hanging in the shadows, keeping out of the heat.
Robert Gordon and Link Ray, and then we play a slow track. Is that all right there, is it?
Well, we used to have a rule. We had the band No Minor Chords and No Slow Songs, and of course we broke it. But that was a song called Baby Don't You Worry About a Thing. That was a hit for us in the 80s from the Rhythm Kings, and then the Gravediggers re-recorded. I won't even get into this, but I have a tendency to reform bands. Gravediggers and Rhythm Kings both got reformed, and that song, we wrote it, myself and Richie Taylor and Mark Clinton wrote that song, sitting on the steps of the Baggot Inn one day, and it did well for us. It became known, and it was, of course, it has a minor chord in it, but it's hard to find it. It's there towards the middle, and it's actually slowish, but we punked it up a little bit. But that was a re-recording of the original track, and I'm very pleased with it. It was, we even have a video, would you believe? We even have a video of that.
Yeah. But no, but I mean, like the way it's all changed now, the democratization of music on the internet, for better or worse, I think probably a lot of it's worse in some ways. But like, I mean, the internet now, there's no middle ground with any of this stuff at all.
Yeah.
Just economically, even, how grim was it? Can you remember? Socially, was it grim or not? Was it good fun? Like, you know, did that impact on the music, the number of young people who wanted to start a band back in those days?
70s and 80s, nobody had any money that I can remember. I just don't remember anyone. But I do remember that everyone went out every night. Mm. I don't know how we quite managed it. I do, like, I remember Mondays, and I remember Tuesdays being rock nights. I think it was a coming of age. The way I looked at that era, that 70s through 80s, was that Dublin or Ireland went into colour from black and white.
Grey. You had been Christian Brothered and you needed to get out of
Christian Brothers. I have a tendency to fire my own bosses, you know, and that's with the Christian Brothers. I learned that I distrusted all authority figures. I found them to be. I went to school in a place in town called Colashtaware, and I just didn't love it. It was Irish language, which I now do love, but at the time I didn't. I saw it as oppressive, and they hated rock music. They hated soccer. They hated rock music, and they hated us because we were Dublin Jackeens with long hair and bad attitudes.
Yeah, your dad was pretty famous.
My dad, yeah,
famous man.
My dad was in the Abbey Theatre. He was Mr. Abbey.
He wasn't just in the Abbey Theatre. He's a bit more than that, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he was my dad, so he was lucky. No, he was. I tell you what about him. He had his own stage, and he and my mum totally adored each other. And the rest of us were extras in their film.
Right.
The film of their lives cast us occasionally and gave us a couple of good lines to say if we were good. But he loved theatre, and what he did was he had a day job where he went in and created worlds in the Abbey Theatre.
Yeah.
And he loved the Abbey Theatre, and that was his life. He was artistic director.
Tomás McCann, what was the title of his job?
Artistic director.
But
he won an Emmy on Broadway for Borstal Boy, and he would have been one of the first Irish people to do that. So he brought that over in the late 60s, early 70s. And I remember him being associated with that play all my life. And I also remember being brought to the Abbey and forced to watch interminable Eugene O'Neill plays for 4.5 hours when your arse turns to marble and you have no meaning at all, it's possible of anything. And people say, you'll remember this for the rest of your life. For all the wrong reasons, probably, you know. But I do remember that. So I kind of have an aversion to going to first nights as a result of that, because I used to be dragged to everything.
Yeah.
And I was just too young. But I did admire him. And I remember going to see one of my favourite memories. In fact, you were talking about the brain hemorrhage earlier. I actually lost my memory when I had the brain hemorrhage. I woke up in a hospital bed, and I didn't remember anything except I knew how to use a knife and fork. I knew I was in hospital. I didn't recognise anybody. I didn't even know my name. And one of the things that changed that was I remembered my dad's play, The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy in the Abbey Theatre. And I remember a car coming on stage, which drove on stage, an old, Chicago gangster car with the lights shining into the audience and then shining into the actors on stage and the scene being played out. And that helped trigger my memory. And then the next thing I remember was I recognised Elvis Costello walking through Dunleary, and I said, that's Elvis Costello. He probably thought it was a fan just yelling at him, but I was getting my memory back.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So those things were important to me. So I had an uneasy relationship with my dad, but it would have been, he was just doing his thing. He kind of noticed me when I was there, but I do remember he brought me to America with him when I was running wild when I was 16. And I spent a summer in the States with him, and that was very important. I got to know American music, I got to see American bands, and I also got to talk to him for the first time. And in that era, you didn't talk to your dad much.
Yeah.
He kind of just gave out to you. And then I got expelled from school and ruined everything.
Right, okay, no, good. That's all. Obviously, bands-wise and music-wise at the time, I mean, like, you know, it was very hard to get paid if you ever did a gig, and there were certain little places all over the country, your Baggots and Toners in Dublin, etc., and then little spots around. And if you did do any tours, it was trying to get paid a lot of the time. These days, you don't get paid at all.
Well, I remember
you pay to play.
In those days, they would give the money to the bouncer.
Yeah.
And the bouncer would take half it for himself.
Yeah, good luck with that.
You never got anywhere with it. I remember when the Rhythm Kings were big in the 80s, it cost us nearly a grand to leave Dublin. We'd have to bring our PA and our vans, and we'd have roadies and sound and everything. It was just insane. And then we'd just about get that amount of money from the gig. So we had nothing, maybe except money
for
pints.
But you're talking about live recordings and all sorts of maybe talk of management and then record companies, and then it all broke up. And then you went on from Rocky Devil and the Gravediggers to the Rhythm Kings.
Yeah.
Was this like, okay, we're going to be serious now?
Yeah, going to be serious now. So we bought a PA, but a PA that kind of got radio stations from the 1920s. It was so bad, so old and crackly.
So a system for people to hear you live on stage.
A system for people to hear me. And we, the only money I think I ever made from music was in a farewell tour at the Rhythm Kings. And the farewell tour was supposed to last a week. And it was doing so well that the farewell tour lasted nearly 6 months because we were actually doing well. And we thought, well, maybe we just keep at it. And we didn't in the end. We did three glorious years as the Rhythm Kings and it broke up when I was 27.
And were they different musically, do you think? Very much so.
The Gravediggers was kind of do-it-yourself punk kind of rock and roll. The Rhythm Kings was kind of a bit more, trying to be a bit more sophisticated. With Eamon Murray on sax and harmonica.
Oh, yeah.
We had a six-piece band. A lot of, I mean, first year was kind of, everyone was everybody's friend. We loved everything. Second year was going to throw each other out of the band. And third year was Heart of Darkness without a script. It was just insane. We'd lost the plot. We didn't know where we were.
I'm going to give you just a tiny little, I know we don't have a lot of time left, but just a little bit here at the Rhythm Kings. Let's take a little blast of this. Every second of all, I don't know why I'm asking you these questions. I know the answers better than you do. Okay, is it a bird? Is it a plane? Ah, it's John Wayne. Okay, but listen, look, we don't have an awful lot of time left for this. I just want to talk about this. You're back now, Rhythm Kings and Rocky De Valera and others, all back into one piece for Toners. What is it exactly that's playing in Toners?
Band is called Rocky De Valera, and Jack Healy's on guitar, Gons Houlihan is on drums, and Mario Carrigan on bass, and my son Finn De Valera. We'll play drums on a couple of numbers, and my daughter Bessa De Valera may even sing a song. So who knows who's going to be. Toners upstairs, and the last time I was in Toners was 35 years ago, and I left a dent in their ceiling. So we've moved from the basement. I don't know if you remember Toners' basement. One way in, one way out.
I don't remember. I remember being at one gig once, and I was talking to somebody. Says Cunis. I said, no, I'm talking here, having a pint. Play louder. I can remember a lot about Toners. I can remember.
But Toners' basement very simple. One way in, one way out. If there was a riot, you just kept playing till the riot stopped.
Yeah, right. If there was a riot every second. Night, frankly.
It was a lot of riots, yeah.
Right.
Best possible taste riots.
Right, indeed. Listen, Ferdy, thanks a million for dropping in. Let's just get that again. You are playing. What's the date again?
It's going to be Sunday, August 30th at 4 o'clock in Toners upstairs, Rocky De Valera Band with guests and some madness.
All right, and that's in Baggot Street in Dublin. Well, listen, thanks a million for talking to us this morning. Come on yourself, Ferdy. Come on yourself, Rocky. Come on yourself, Rhythm, whatever your name.